This is Free Thought Radio with your hosts, Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
Oh, godless ones, I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist.
Free Thought Radio is broadcasting.
This show is produced by the Freedom From Religion Foundation. If you're concerned about keeping state and church separate, and if you're concerned about the incursions into our government and into society by the religious right, then you will want to join our group. We're the largest national organization of atheists and agnostics working to keep state and church separate, and to educate the public about the views of non-believers. Our guest later in the show today will be Eric Maisel. He's the author of the book called The Atheist's Way, Living Well Without Gods.
But speaking of gods in government, we want to spend the first half of Free Thought Radio dissecting the decision by the new administration to retain a faith-based office in the White House and at the cabinets, just renaming it from the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives to the White House Council of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. And you'll remember, Dan, you remember that outcry that greeted Bush's 2001 announcement that he was creating a faith-based office in the White House?
It was a radical move on his part.
And it was by executive order. And after that outcry, Bush hastily tacked on the addition of community initiatives to the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. But all that emphasis has been on faith-based.
So now, taking a cue from the Bush script, President Barack Obama has, instead of rescinding Bush's faith-based orders, he's reissued the executive order to create the Council of Faith-Based Partnerships. And also, as we know, it is taking on those extra words, and neighborhood partnership to make it look a little more secular.
So that was a blow to the First Amendment, and it was an expected blow since Obama had announced as a candidate last summer that he would be doing this in some fashion or another. In fact, he pledged $500 million in faith-based aid last July. We haven't seen a price tag yet on his new scheme to keep the faith-based offices at 11 agencies.
So looking back, you'll remember this pledge by Obama from last July.
But I don't believe this partnership will endanger that idea so long as we follow a few basic principles. First, if you get a federal grant, you can't use that grant money to proselytize to the people you help, and you can't discriminate against them or against the people you hire on the basis of their religion.
However, in his announcement on February the 5th, President Obama said something different from what he said when he was a candidate. He did not rescind Bush's policy of saying that groups which get federal funds can't discriminate in hiring and firing. He said it will be decided on a case-by-case basis by the Attorney General's office.
And you can imagine the mess and imagine how efficient and effective that will be. What's going on here?
Obama made the announcement. He's signing his faith-based council executive order at the National Prayer Breakfast held in Washington, D.C. last February the 2nd. The keynote speech at that prayer breakfast was by former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, a recent convert to Roman Catholicism.
And we all know there's nothing worse than a recent convert.
There are limits to humanism, and beyond those limits, God and only God can work.
Now, you have to beware politicians who give up government responsibility to God. What was your reaction to that statement, Dan?
Well, government officials are hired to do a job, which is a humanistic job. It's a job of a secular job of the people. It's like if I was getting on an airplane and I saw the pilot praying before taking off, I'd get off that plane again because they're admitting that they don't have what it takes to do their jobs.
And it was nice to know that the pilot Sullenberger was not praying when he was crash landing onto the Hudson River. That was in 60 Minutes. That was very refreshing.
Are there any people out there with a gift of faith healing who can pray for my voice
today?
Yeah,
it's not working so well. So before we get to this troubling stuff of Barack Obama's speech at the National Prayer Breakfast, he did make some very thoughtful remarks at that prayer breakfast, remarks that are unusual to hear from a 21st century American politician.
We've seen faith wielded as a tool to divide us from one another, as an excuse for prejudice and intolerance. It's a theme that we heard from Tony. Wars have been waged. Innocents have been slaughtered. For centuries, entire religions have been persecuted, all in the name of perceived righteousness. There's no doubt that the very nature of faith means that some of our beliefs will never be the same. We read from different texts. We follow different edicts. We subscribe to different accounts of how we came to be here and where we are going next. And some subscribe to no faith at all.
He's right. Faith is divisive. And he's right. Wars have been waged in the name of faith. So why do we need faith?
And in particular here, faith and government linked are deadly. We know that from history, that once religion and government unites, there's inevitably persecution. So this is why we do not want a faith-based office at the White House. Now, we also heard from a lot of freethinkers who were pleased that Barack Obama mentioned his birth family's lack of religiosity.
I had a father who was born a Muslim but became an atheist, and grandparents who were non-practicing Methodists and Baptists, and a mother who was skeptical of organized religion, even though she was the kindest, most spiritual person I've ever known.
All right, that sounds good to me. I mean, there's no accounting for taste. Then we get to this conversion, which Obama very publicly advertises.
I didn't become a Christian until many years later when I moved to the south side of Chicago after college. And it happened not because of indoctrination or a sudden revelation, but because I spent month after month working with church folks who simply wanted to help neighbors who were down on their luck. It was there that I felt called to a higher purpose. His purpose.
So we do have free exercise of religion, and as I said, there's no accounting for taste. but Barack Obama was raised without religion. He admits that his mother was the kindest person he ever knew. So in other words, you don't need religion to do kindly things. So I think there's a little bit of a logic flaw there.
Were these Christians in Chicago kinder than his mother?
I mean, he's impressed by some individuals in Chicago, but if that's what you're going to look for, do-gooders in Chicago, then why not look at the tremendous example of somebody like Jane Addams, the founder of Hull House? Addams insisted that Hull House should be secular. She said, she wrote in her book, "People prefer a rational world to believe in and live in."
You don't
so
mean
why,
Hell House, Hull, H-U-L-L.
Yes, Hull House. Why doesn't Obama try emulating Jane Addams for change? And this idea that religion has some corner on charity is the greatest myth of all time. Religion gets the credit for so much that taxpayers get the bill for, and religion in our country grabs the greatest chunk of charitable giving, yet studies show that most donations are used for church infrastructure, for salaries, and religious promotion.
I'm Dan Barker, and I'm here with Annie Laurie Gaylor. This is Free Thought Radio on Air America. We're dissecting the remarks of President Barack Obama that he made at the February 2nd National Prayer Breakfast and his decision to continue the faith-based offices at the White House and federal agencies. If you haven't protested this yet, we encourage you to phone the White House comment line at 202-456-1111. That's 202-456-1111. Or go to the White House email comment section at whitehouse.gov/contact and make a big fuss.
We'll be right back to analyze and respond to some of the president's more pious pronouncements at the National Prayer Breakfast.
Ask for a sample issue of Free Thought today and find out more about the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. Speaking freely, thinking freely. This is Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio, discussing President Obama's announcement at the National Prayer Breakfast on February 2nd that he is continuing the Bush's faith-based initiatives, that he is keeping a faith-based office in the White House and at about 11 agencies. This is where Obama lauds the National Prayer Breakfast itself.
It's a tradition that I'm told actually began many years ago in the city of Seattle. It was at the height of the Great Depression, and most people found themselves out of work. Many fell into poverty, and some lost everything. The leaders of the community did all that they could for those who were suffering in their midst. And then they decided to do something more. They prayed.
Prayer is not doing something more. Prayer is doing something less.
I'm doing nothing.
Prayer is the ultimate non-action. It's an admission that you don't know what to do.
It's admission at failure.
It's a cop-out.
At the Freedom From Religion Foundation, we have a saying, nothing fails like prayer. People who pray should not pat themselves on the back that they have accomplished anything more than, I don't know, groupthink or self-delusion or wishful thinking, at most, self-calming.
And here's the line that I object to the most.
But no matter what we choose to believe, let us remember that there is no religion whose central tenet is hate. There's no God who condones taking the life of an innocent human being. This much we know.
Has Barack Obama ever read the Bible that he claims to uphold? If he's typical of many believers, particularly liberal believers, he really doesn't know what's inside the covers of the so-called Holy Bible. He says hate is not a central tenet, but it is a huge tenet within the Bible. In fact, it's an integral part of the teachings of Jesus. Jesus said, "Think not that I'm come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. I came to set a man at variance against his father, the daughter against her mother." He preaches in Matthew 10. He says, "If any man comes to me and hates not his father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters and his own life also, he can't be my disciple," in Luke 14. The crown teaching of Christianity is that it is praiseworthy for a father to sacrifice his own son to pay for the so-called sins of humankind.
Yeah, and sacrifice to a deity. We are talking really primitive magical thinking here. It's such a cruel teaching masquerading as love. That child sacrifice is a loving act that's good. This is very corrupting to our culture. And I would add that mass killings in the name of God are one of the major themes of the Old Testament. It takes 10 typeset pages just to list the major mass killings that were ordered, committed, or approved by the God of the Bible. And that's chapter 5 of Ruth Hermance Greene's The Born Again Skeptic's Guide to the Bible, which is the first book that the Foundation ever published. It's still available. "Happy shall be he that taketh and dasheth thy little ones against the stones." This is just one of endless godly injunctions to slaughter innocents.
That's Psalm 137:9, and yet Obama says there's no condoning of the taking of the life of innocent human being. Once again, is the idea that religion is basically something good. It's a synonym for charity, used as an excuse to intermeddle religion and government.
This myth is used as a reason for intermeddling.
To justify this continuing of Bush's faith-based initiative. Obama claims that taking some responsibility for the well-being of people requires a living, breathing, active faith. And he's not talking about faith in humankind. He's talking about religious faith. Our guest later in today's show, of course, will address that very myth. He's the author of the book called The Atheist's Way, Living Well Without God.
So the upshot is that our nation is told that when we're needing and awaiting sweeping action and reform on this economic crisis, we're being told to pray. And when the national treasury is bleeding, we're being told to throw more tax dollars at religion.
And the White House bragged that Obama's faith-based effort will be broader than Bush's. The White House faith-based office will be, quote, "a substantial programming and policy arm of the federal government." Obama officially named a 26-year-old Pentecostal minister to head the White House's new faith-based office. His name is Josh Dubois.
Now, Sarah Palin came under a lot of criticism for her Pentecostal past. Dan, what do Pentecostals typically believe?
The typical Pentecostal speaks in tongues, practices faith healing, believes in the gift of prophecy. Most Pentecostals are young earth creationists. So what will be his ideas about science? They are quite literalist in the Bible.
Most of them would be anti-gay, anti-feminist.
Most of them, yes, of course.
I mean, we don't know what Josh Dubois, I don't know how you say his name, what his particular views are, but he's only 26 and he's been given the reins of a faith-based office in the White House, and this is very concerning. Secularists and freethinkers, the people who are the true conservatives, those of us who wish to conserve what is greatest about our country and its godless constitution, must really make a great fuss over this blow to the Establishment Clause. Phone the White House comment line. It's 202-456-1111, 202-456-1111, or go to the White House at www.whitehouse.gov and go to the contact and make a fuss about this. This is not what we were expecting from the Obama administration. And we do have releases online at ffrf.org. You can look under the news release link at our website at ffrf.org if you want that telephone number, if you want the email contact information, or if you just want more information about this development.
The faith-based schemes, you might remember, were actually at the instigation of John Ashcroft. Before the Charitable Choice Act of the late 90s and Bush's faith-based initiative, religious charities were granted vast sums of money to provide social services, and we don't object to that. All they had to do was to take their crosses down and create a secular arm and keep separate books. What we object to is that none of these safeguards are now in place. Where public money goes, public accountability should follow. Obama should have returned to these simple safeguards.
I'm Annie Laura Gaylor with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this break to talk about Living Well Without Gods. The author, Eric Maisel, author of The Atheist's Way, Living Well Without Gods. We hope Barack Obama will read this book.
Yeah.
And we'll be enjoying talking about something positive about atheism, positive about non-faith.
I'm Michael Newtow, and this is Free Thought Radio.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so.
And I'm Dan Barker with Annie Lori Gaylor for Free Thought Radio. There's been a lot of books written and a lot of things said about what's wrong with religion, but what about what's right with atheism? Our guest on our show today is Eric Maisel. He's the author of this new book, The Atheist's Way. That's atheist apostrophe S. The Atheist's Way, Living Well Without Gods. A wonderful book. Eric Maisel has a PhD. He's a psychotherapist, a philosopher. He calls himself a cultural observer, and he's one of America's foremost creativity coaches. His other books he's written include The Van Gogh Blues, Fearless Creating, and Coaching the Artist Within. He lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, and we've got him on the phone right now.
Welcome to Free Thought Radio.
Hi, Annie and Dan. Great to be here.
Oh, nice to talk to you finally after reading your book, to hear your voice. First of all, what is a creativity coach?
It's a semi-new profession, probably 6, 7, 8 years old now, and we're a sub-branch of the coaching world. And we specialize in working with creative and performing artists on any issues that a creative person might bring up, whether it's blockage or everyday blues of having the work rejected or trying to figure out how to survive as an artist. We deal with all of those issues as creativity coaches.
Can you help me with my jazz improvised solos?
I can do anything.
Wow, okay.
Is there very much money in this? It seems like a lot of artists are starving.
I just saw a figure put out by the International Coach Federation, which is the largest coaching federation, and they train everyday coaches, life coaches and what have you. 85% of their coaches never coach a single client. So it is a very hard profession to earn a living at. I'm one of the few coaches who probably does earn a living at it. So that's the long answer to that reality testing question.
Well, I'm glad you are getting a earning a living.
Well, and your book itself is very, very creative. We've been reading all these wonderful books about the delusion of God and about the problems with religion, and yet you come along and you talk about where do we go from here. Were you raised religious?
No, I was raised by my mother, a single parent, and she was culturally Jewish, but there was no religion in the household. When I turned 13, or just as I was turning 13, we had a conversation, and she said, "Do I want a bar mitzvah?" And I said, "I don't know what that is." Huh. And she said, "Well, maybe you ought to have one in case later you want to have one." So I went to the shul and phonetically read something and had a bar mitzvah. But that was my entire religious education.
That's kind of like Ira Gershwin. The exact same thing happened. And he didn't want to do it, but his mother had a new hat that she wanted to show off. So they went ahead and did it, and that was it. No more religion.
I think it was about the sponge cake and the schnapps, if I remember correctly.
So in your book, The Atheist Way, there's many interesting chapters here. But what really impressed me the most is the chapter about meaning and purpose in life. And I think one of the central keys of your whole book is this idea that we don't run around desperately seeking meaning. We find meaning. Can you talk about that as an atheist?
Sure. I think that is the paradigm shift for this century. That's the place we would like people to move. And that's from seeking meaning, which is a very old metaphor. It's thousands of years old. It was reinforced in the 60s and 70s by the human potential movement and find your guru and go to India and all of those sorts of things. To move from that metaphor of seeking meaning to the idea of making meaning, to the idea that we know enough already to stand where we want to stand, to represent ourselves the way we want to represent ourselves, to do the things we know we ought to do. I think a lot of people use religion and spiritual enthusiasms and other pursuits to keep themselves from deciding where they actually want to make meaning. They keep themselves on the run, and I think it's time for us to stop running.
It's like that old joke that a lot of people make it to the top of the ladder to find out it's been leaning against the wrong wall.
Exactly.
They're following somebody else's code for life, thinking if I measure up to this, that makes me a good, meaningful person.
And they also don't have to stand behind their own ideas and their own opinions. I think one of the central tenets of atheism as I see it is that each of us is a leader. And a lot of people would prefer to be followers. And I think we want to hold their hands and help them move from the idea of following to individual leadership.
We've noticed in our group that if you want to call atheism a movement, I don't. But if you want to call it a movement, it's a very strange movement because it's a movement with no followers.
Exactly.
Every single person is their own leader. There's no popes or bishops or people telling you what you must think.
That's exactly right. And I try to keep expressing that sentiment that you just expressed clearly by whenever I state an opinion saying, it's my opinion, you'll have to think about this for yourself, you'll have to come to your own conclusions, etc. That becomes very cumbersome to have to keep saying that, but I think we're honor-bound to keep reminding people they have to figure these things out for themselves.
I do that a lot in debates and public speeches. I have to always say, I don't speak for all atheists, but I think most atheists feel this way.
I barely speak for myself.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you have another chapter that we make our own ethics, and we want to play a little excerpt from a recent Jon Stewart show where this comes up. But briefly, what do you mean by that, we make our own ethics?
I believe that ethics are subjective. We look out into the world in context, and then we bring our ethical sense, our principles to the moment. And that's why ethics must change, because they are subjective. We may be for a war one minute, think it's a good war, then learn more information about the roots of that war and decide that it's a bad war. Any simple slogan about war is good or war is bad can't possibly capture the truth of our ethics. Our ethics are rooted in the actual circumstances of a situation.
Gosh, I have to say, I'm opposed to most wars. Just sort of.
Well, there might be one or two.
Violence.
You might be for our intervention in World War II, perhaps.
Perhaps.
I've had this conversation with my sister-in-law. She would not even have been for our intervention in World War II. But at any rate.
Yeah.
Now, let's listen to this little excerpt from the Jon Stewart show. He's interviewing Randall Balmer, who's the author of, I think it's called God in the White House. And this very interesting conversation ensues that we want you to comment on.
Do you think it will fade? Is this a great awakening? Does it follow, or is this now the standard? Do you think we could ever elect an atheist? Now we have a black president. Right. Could an atheist? What'll come first? Black woman, Hispanic, gay, Jew, atheist. Where you go?
I think pretty much in that order. I think the.
I hope somebody wrote that down.
And I think atheist is probably at the end because we Americans want to know about our candidates' faith. What we really want to know is, are they good people? Are they moral? Are they trustworthy?
But when did good person get intricately linked to faith? Why can't goodness be a virtue without fear of biblical punishment or any of those types of things?
Well, it certainly can. But I think in America, for many Americans, most Americans, religion is a proxy for morality. So what we really want to know is, are they moral? Are they good people? And the only way we can frame the question is ask, do you go to church? Are you a religious person? And I think the problem is that we, as the voters, take those kind of blithe responses at face value, and we should interrogate those claims.
So, Eric Maisel, what's your response to this? I mean, I think there's a lot to say about it. You've written a book called Living Well Without Gods. Why should we reject this really silly notion that you're not a good person if you don't believe in God?
If you ask a believer how she makes any decision, any moral decision, let's say it's staying with this sick child or going across town and taking care of her aging mother over there, if she's truthful, she says she thinks it through. She pulls up her principles and makes a decision in the moment about which next right thing to do. And there's nothing Bible-based, God-based. There are no spiritual enthusiasms there at all. It's her simply thinking through how she wants to represent herself in the moment as a moral person. It's what everybody does, believer or non-believer alike. It's just that non-believers know they're doing that and are willing to say that, and believers are less willing to say that all they are doing is standing still in the moment and making a certain kind of decision based on their own psychological makeup.
Well, I was a preacher. I used to say that human beings left alone don't want to be good. We're actually selfish and evil, and that religion is what motivates us or somehow gets us to wanting to be good, to please God or escape hell or go to heaven or something. And then if you don't have religion making you do that, we're going to fall back on our evil human nature. What do you think about that?
I think we're a mixed bag. I think that, again, from a leadership standpoint, it would be wonderful if people, atheists, but all people, supported the idea that we would rather see good people around than immoral people around. I think it's part of our task to educate that both are within us.
Well, I think I agree with you. I think, you know, and Jefferson said that we had an instinct to be good and compassionate. We're going to take a break. We're talking with Eric Maisel, the author of the book, The Atheist's Way, Living Well Without Gods. I'm Dan Barker here with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio. We'll be right back.
Find out more about Free Thought Radio and the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021.
This is the church. This is the steeple. Open the doors. Get in there, you atheist.
Speaking freely, thinking freely. This is Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker, host of Free Thought Radio with co-host Annie Laurie Gaylor. And we're talking with Eric Maisel, who's the author of the book, The Atheist's Way, Living Well Without Gods. Now, Eric, I came out of religion and you didn't. And for me, the process of going from believer to non-believer was like having a large debt canceled. It didn't get me anything positive. It's kind of like getting your bank account up to zero. But what a wonderful thing to happen. And in chapter two of your book, you give a lot of personal first-person stories of people who did that and their feelings. And first, how did you get those interviews? And what do these people say?
I have a large newsletter list, and I invited some subsection of that newsletter list to join a smaller cyberspace group where we talked about atheist issues. And I invited that group to, if they were not lifelong atheists but had left religion, to share those stories with me for publication. And I got hundreds and hundreds of stories. There are probably, I don't know what, between 6 and 12 stories in that chapter. But they really reflect hundreds of people speaking about the journey of leaving their religion and moving towards atheism. Some found it very hard to do. Some find it still hard, primarily because of social reasons, dealing with their family. Some found it quite easy to do. Each had a different story, sort of the whole range, the whole spectrum of from hardness to ease.
Now, what about even atheists get down and maybe get depressed occasionally? Or how do atheists, if they don't have a big security blanket or a comfort like the father figure to turn to, what do atheists do when things get tough in life?
Well, I think it's a really interesting and complicated subject. We conflate the word depression and make it stand for a lot of different things, for biological depression and social depression and psychological depression and existential depression. Those are the four major depressions, but we just use the word depression to stand for all of that. I think that believers suffer from more psychological depression than do atheists, because at the root of psychological depression is inner conflict, and I think that they are more conflicted about what's going on in life. So I think that's what they gain when a believer moves from belief to atheism. I think they feel more psychologically well, and that depression lessens. However, I think atheists probably suffer from existential depression more than other groups, because I think we're existentially sensitive. I think we're interested in questions of meaning. So whereas the believer may have more psychological depression, I think we may have more existential depression. For us, then, the solution, the remedy, is to, as we were talking about previously, make meaning. Because it's an existential depression, what's actually happening is that they're wondering if they matter, or if their efforts matter. And the remedy for wondering about that is to make a decision, a certain kind of decision, that you're going to invest meaning in the next hour, the next day, the next month, and keep up with that heroic struggle.
I have my own answer for when things are like that.
Probably shorter than mine.
I sit down and play jazz piano, and that works for me.
It kind of you do that anyway, Dan.
Oh, yeah. You know,
you wouldn't want us to be only depressed to do that,
yeah.
Would you?
Yeah, I think everybody in the world should practice piano for 4 hours a day to be like me, right? So they can find the same meaning I have.
That's exactly right.
But the point is, that's something that I made. That's something of me, right, that I chose to invest into. And everybody's different. Everybody's going to find
something. That's right. I think this is really, you know, arbitrary, and no one has to agree. But I think there are probably about a dozen adequate meaning containers out there, ways to make meaning that are psychologically satisfying, things like creativity and service and accomplishment and just being, etc. We could talk about these dozen, but I think the person who hopes for one way to make meaning, and that's what a religious person is really looking for, an answer to a question, the person who's looking for that misses the understanding that there are many meaning opportunities, many meaning adventures, and many different ways to make meaning in life.
I remember a story that Andrianne told us about her husband, Carl Sagan. He was giving a talk at a university, and a student came up afterwards and said, Dr. Sagan, if everything you say is true, then what, if everything I was raised to believe isn't true, then what meaning is there left in my life? What can I grab onto? And Carl looked at the student and said, do something meaningful.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He said it first.
Well, I think as long as there's a problem to solve, as long as there, you know.
A tummy to fill.
Yeah.
Or a child to take care of. Or
exactly. Relationships is one of those places of meaning, absolutely.
Or a state church problem to fix.
Yeah. Who's to say
this? Or an injustice.
That Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who's to say she had no meaning in her life? She was an atheist, but she worked for 50 years for women's rights.
Exactly.
She had great meaning in her life. It doesn't have to be that kind of large
figure. And I think it's important to understand that our meanings shift. I think that's important because I think most people, even atheists, are in fact looking for one meaning that is larger than other meanings, whether it's service or accomplishment or what have you. They're looking for one that maybe should, so to speak, stand out from the others. I don't think there is one that stands out. I think there are lots of co-equal.
Jazz piano, it is.
Yeah, there are lots of co-equal meaning containers, and we can shift in a given day from relating to being of service to accomplishing something. We can shift all through the day and make different kinds of meaning all through the day.
Well, thank you very much, Eric Maisel, for joining us today. And how can folks get hold of your book, The Atheist's Way, Living Well Without Gods?
Should be everywhere. They can also visit the website associated with the book, which is www.theatheistsway.com. And they can also visit my main site, which is ericmaisel.com, and that's ericmaisel.com.
And it's published by New World Library. Well, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, guys. It's been great.
And thank all of you listeners for joining us. We want to thank our producer on the show. His name is Dan Ginsberg. What is this, your fourth time now with us? Or?
I think, yeah, this is number four.
You're almost getting it now, right?
Thanks.
Yeah, you're getting good at it. Well, anybody named Dan, you know.
Oh, yeah, it's a great name.
If you want to hear any of our past shows, including this show, I think there's about 150 shows now, you can go to our website, which is ffrf.org/radio/podcast, right? And you can hear all the archives, and you can hear all the podcasts. And you also, if you listen to iTunes, just go to iTunes and look up podcasts. You can find us there, too.
And we invite you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Ask for more information at ffrf.org, a sample copy of the January-February issue. You can phone 1-800-335-4021. Or better yet, just join us, and you get 10 issues a year of our newspaper. Thank you for joining us today. We thank our guest, Eric Maisel. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.